Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1202, I will have two segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, including the ongoing Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip and Israeli atrocities in the West Bank. After that, I will share with you a segment from Christ at the Checkpoint podcast, in which Palestinian Christian theologian and pastor, the Reverend Dr. Munzir Ishaq, responds to claims by war criminal Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court, that apartheid Israel is a safe haven for Christians. But let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 846 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Heavy Israeli shelling and tank fire remain constant across Gaza. Sources with Al Jazeera reported that Israeli forces targeted areas east of Khan Yunis on Wednesday, and warplanes bombed empty homes east of the city of Deir al-Balah in areas controlled and occupied by the Israeli military. At least two explosions took place in the north of Gaza as the Israeli army carried out demolitions in Jabalia and shelled neighborhoods east of Gaza City. Journalist Mahmoud Abu Salama recorded footage of Israeli gunfire on Jabalia camp on Sunday. He captioned this video, quote, "Despite talk of ceasefire in Gaza, this is the daily life of the residents of Jabalia camp in northern Gaza." Israeli attacks killed three Palestinians and injured three others on Tuesday in Gaza City, according to the Anadolu news agency. Among those killed was a 17-year-old boy. Israeli soldiers shot and killed a Palestinian in Jabalia on Monday, and a man was wounded by Israeli fire east of Gaza City that same day, as the Israeli army continued extensive bulldozing operations in the Al-Sanafur area and around the Al-Barch cemetery. These operations included the desecration of graves under the pretext of searching for the body of the last remaining Israeli prisoner of war in the Gaza Strip, which was returned on Monday. The Israeli army announced a large-scale search operation inside the Gaza Strip for the missing soldier and began desecrating the cemetery in eastern Gaza City, exhuming graves and destroying remains. Reporter Mahmoud Ghazi recorded footage in the aftermath of the destruction of the cemetery on Tuesday. Local sources told the Wafa news agency that the area and its surroundings were subjected to heavy artillery shelling and intense gunfire from military vehicles, as well as sniper fire and quadcopter drones, resulting in fatalities and dozens of injuries. Euromed Human Rights Monitor said it had reviewed documented reports indicating that the Israeli army dug up nearly 200 graves in the cemetery. Over the past 2 years, the human rights group says, quote, "Israel has systematically destroyed cemeteries in the Gaza Strip, dug up and vandalized graves, tampered with bodies, and transferred dozens of remains." The Israeli army has destroyed 21 out of 60 cemeteries in the Gaza Strip over the past 2 years and has systematically vandalized cemeteries and exhumed graves in all areas where it conducted ground incursions, Euromed added. Quote, "These actions included bulldozing graves, extracting remains, and crushing them with military machinery, repeatedly causing the mixing, loss, and disappearance of remains, as well as damage to neighboring graves." At least two infants have died due to hypothermia this week as Israel's blockade on proper shelters and caravans remains in place. On Saturday, a three-month-old infant, Ali Abu Zor, died from extreme cold and was taken to Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, according to the health ministry in Gaza. The ministry reported on Tuesday, January 27th, that another baby, a 12-day-old newborn named Haytham Abu Qas, also died at Al-Rantisi Hospital from hypothermia, bringing the total number of child deaths from the cold this winter season to at least 11. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed two Palestinians this week in separate attacks. Qusay Maher Ismail Halaika, 28, was shot and killed near a checkpoint in Bethlehem. Wafa News Agency said that Israeli soldiers shot him and then left him to bleed on the ground. That killing followed the execution of a 20-year-old Palestinian, Mohammed Rajeh Nasrallah, on Tuesday by Israeli forces during a military raid south of Al-Khalil. Nasrallah was shot in the abdomen, according to the health ministry. During the raid, another youth was shot and injured with live ammunition. Israeli forces shot and wounded a Palestinian teenager also on Tuesday in the Qalandia refugee camp and the adjacent town of Kufr Aqab, north of occupied Jerusalem. Wafa News Agency said that the teenager was injured during the second consecutive day of Israeli aggressions inside the refugee camp and Kufr Aqab, including the carrying out of demolitions of dozens of buildings, facilities, and infrastructure under the pretext of security claims and lacking Israeli-issued permits. Approximately 40 separate structures have been demolished in the area since the raid began, as heavy military vehicles and bulldozers are working to impose what the Jerusalem governorate calls a buffer zone alongside Israel's wall in the West Bank. Also in East Jerusalem, Israeli police and intelligence forces raided and shut down a screening of the feature film Palestine 36 at the Yabus Cultural Center on January 22nd. The Yabus Center stated that a unit from the intelligence services stormed the venue during the screening and ordered organizers to stop the viewing without presenting a judicial warrant. They also arrested the projectionist. Palestine 36, directed by Anne-Marie Jasser and shortlisted for an Academy Award, is about the 1936 to 1939 Arab revolt against British colonial rule in Palestine and portrays the roots of the Palestinian liberation struggle. The Israelis said that the Yabus Center was screening a film, quote, promoting work by a terrorist organization. The center described the move as, quote, a direct assault on freedom of expression and cultural activity in the city, adding that it reflects escalating restrictions imposed by Israeli authorities on Palestinian cultural life in Jerusalem in violation of international laws and conventions. Meanwhile, Israeli settler violence continues to expand across the West Bank with the support and participation of Israeli army forces. The United Nations Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights stated this week that, quote, state-backed settler violence has become a key driver of forced displacement, chipping away at Palestinian presence in strategic locations. Such settler-driven displacement, particularly in Bedouin and herding communities, usually follows the same pattern. An illegal outpost is erected near or inside a herding community. Settlers restrict Palestinians' access to water and grazing space. Settlers repeatedly attack communities, destroy property, infrastructure, and livestock, and injure or kill residents, the UN office said. On January 27th, approximately 300 Israeli Jewish settlers attacked areas in Masafer Yatta, south of Al-Khalil, and injured Palestinians, torched homes and property, stole livestock, and blocked ambulances that arrived to evacuate the injured, the UN said. Wafa News Agency reported that one of the injured, Samir Hamamda, said he was beaten by settlers when a mob descended on his house, pelting it with stones and pepper spraying inside, wounding his wife and children. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said it treated two patients in the village of Al-Fakit, including a young man with a head injury and a girl with a broken hand. Other residents in the Masafer Yatta area were also injured, including women and children, when the settlers smashed the windows of vehicles and homes. In Khirbet al-Halawa, several Palestinians were hurt by stones thrown by the settlers, who also stole 150 sheep from the area, Wafa reported. Mohamed Hureini, a resident of Masafariyata and the co-founder of the Youth of Samud project, filmed the attack on Tuesday. He said, quote, "Over the past 5 hours, settler militias carried out a brutal pogrom against my people in my village, Masafariyata. The violent settlers stormed homes, burned properties, destroyed vehicles, and stole livestock. Settlers did not stop there. Their violence brought numerous injuries among civilians. All of this happened in full view of the Israeli army and police, who stood by and did nothing. Not a single settler was arrested. On the contrary, Israeli settlers assaulted two Palestinian women, and the soldiers arrested them, the women. It is organized terror carried out and enabled by the military with total impunity."
Settlers set up fire in front of the houses of the Palestinians. On the other side, you can see settlers, soldiers, watching the pogrom that was happening here. We are trying now to turn off the fire.
On January 25th, Israeli settlers assaulted and injured Palestinian herders in the Rajum Ali area in the South Hebron Hills and ran over a 13-year-old Palestinian boy with a tractor, fracturing his leg. Israeli security forces were present during the attack but fired tear gas and stun grenades toward the Palestinian residents, the United Nations said. On Monday, January 26th, following repeated attacks and threats by Israeli settlers, the remaining 100 residents of the Ras Ain al-Auja Bedouin community near Jericho were forced to leave the area, bringing the number of people displaced from that community this month to about 600, according to the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. The office said that, quote, "settlers had damaged or blocked herders' access to grazing areas around the community and prevented them from using the nearby spring, severely undermining their livelihoods. This comes on top of livestock theft and frequent attacks resulting in injuries and property damage." Since the beginning of January, the UN Human Rights Office, OCHA, has recorded the displacement of 688 Palestinians from 8 communities due to settler attacks, which is over 40% the number of displaced people in that category for the whole of 2025. It also comes on top of the displacement of another 130 Palestinians this month due to demolitions. OCHA is carrying out assessments and working with humanitarian partners to ensure people receive the support they need, OCHA said. Other settler attacks were recorded this past week in Jerusalem, the central and northern West Bank, the Jordan Valley, and the South Hebron Hills. The attacks resulted in extensive property damage, arson attacks, injuries, and forcible displacement of Palestinian families, primarily affecting Bedouin and herding households, according to the UN. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Trapped Between Two Different Worlds by Ahmed Abu Shawish, writing from Gaza. It's 9 p.m. Gaza time, Abu Shawish writes. Rain is pounding against the broken, nylon-covered windows of my family's home in Nusayrat, central Gaza, and the wind pushes through every small crack. I'm sitting at my desk, holding a cup of coffee, and thinking about my father. We had a routine before 2023 of late-night conversation, coffee, and long walks. But tonight there will be no long walk, and our conversation is happening through a WhatsApp video call. When he calls, I can hear the rain twice, once from outside my window and once through his phone speakers, from thousands of kilometers away in Italy. The same storm falling on two different worlds. My father, Dr. Mohamed Abu Shawish, was evacuated from Gaza to Italy in September 2025, leaving behind the six of us, including my mother and my four siblings. Tonight, through a screen, we try to recreate the comfort of our walks and late-night talks, but nothing feels the same. His face is lit by the warm, stable light of an apartment in Europe, mine by the dim yellow of a battery-powered lamp. My father and I share the same quiet nature. We don't complain easily, and we don't talk about our fears much. In September 2023, he was awarded a scholarship to continue his postdoctoral studies at the University of Milano Bicocca, with a departure date of October that year. He postponed his studies several times, despite the multiple calls from the Italian embassy urging him to evacuate. He chose to remain with us through those early months of devastation and displacement. He believed that the genocide would soon come to an end and that we would all be able to go to Italy. However, that hope slowly faded over time. After more than 700 days, we reached the painful conviction that the suffering might last indefinitely. My father called the embassy in September 2025, hoping that it might evacuate all of us. But later that month, on a Friday morning, an official at the embassy called back with a message, "You'll be evacuated on Monday." Before he could even ask about his family, the official added, "But unfortunately, alone." My father asked on the video call if I had started studying Italian. It wasn't the first time he had mentioned it. Ever since he reached Milan, he has encouraged me to learn the language, repeating, "You have to prepare yourself to come here." But I have not started to learn Italian. I can't quite believe I will ever go there. I nod and say, "Inshallah." This time, though, I laughed and told him that I barely have time for that. My days are consumed by my engineering courses at the Islamic University of Gaza, interrupted constantly by errands and lines to buy food and retrieve water. He stayed silent for a moment, then asked, "What are you waiting for?" "Maybe because I don't see the point," I said. "Why should I waste time preparing for a future that might never arrive?" He said I needed to get rid of these pessimistic thoughts. "You should learn Italian because it's the key to our reunification. Nothing else matters more." I didn't respond because I wasn't sure what the honest answer was. Instead, I stared at the blurry pixels of his face. I nodded and said, "Inshallah," even though we both knew it was less a promise and more a way to keep the door from closing completely. Those are excerpts from Trapped Between Two Different Worlds by Ahmad Abushawish, an engineering student, journalist, and activist based in Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine and around the world. In Gaza, our recent guest, Maha Husseini, a researcher with Euromed Human Rights Monitor, posted this photo on Wednesday of two young people painting a mural on a wall in Gaza City. Here's what Maha writes. Quote, "The University Square is one of Gaza City's most familiar landmarks. It holds the buildings of Gaza's two oldest universities, Al-Azhar University and the Islamic University, places that once pulsed with life. For years, this square was one of the city's busiest roads, shaped by the countless taxis and the daily footsteps of students arriving from every corner of the strip, carrying notebooks and doing last-minute revision for exams as they crossed the street. During the genocide in Gaza, this place was nearly destroyed. Some university buildings were bombed, while others were seized and converted into military bases by Israeli occupation forces. Roads were devastated, infrastructure damaged, and the square that once gathered knowledge was reduced to rubble. I loved this street. I knew it by heart. Here, I earned both my bachelor's and master's degrees. I remember its rain-soaked pavements, how the light reflected on the asphalt, how the city felt alive beneath my feet. This street also housed the media office where I found myself involuntarily becoming a journalist during Israel's 51-day offensive on Gaza in 2014, documenting a war while still learning how to name the world. I witnessed life and death here. I learned, I grew up, and I ran from airstrikes along the same road again and again. As fate would have it, my temporary office during the ongoing genocide now stands on this street. Every morning, I walk past my wounded university. I watch students crossing the devastated roads to reach their lectures, entering the same classrooms where I once studied languages, learning how to speak, how to testify, how to carry our story beyond these walls. Earlier this week, I passed by and saw a young woman and a young man painting a damaged wall of the university. They layered fresh colors over cracks and scorch marks, not to erase what happened, but to refuse its final word. In a place where the occupation tried to silence learning, these young people chose color once again. On a street devastated to crush life, students still arrive every morning. But most of all, I cherish this morning's painting because amid the ruins of a square that once taught me how to speak, life continues to insist on being heard. That's Maha Husseini writing from Gaza. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza.
You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Palestinian Christians in occupied Palestine have been reporting Israeli atrocities against them for many years, and we have been reporting on them for a very long time. Christians have been targeted just like Muslims in occupied Palestine, as Israel has been working on an ethnic cleansing plan to get rid of the Palestinians from Palestine, regardless of their religion. They just don't want Palestinians there. Despite countless accounts from Palestinian Christians and other Christians visiting occupied Palestine of Israeli atrocities against them, the Israeli Prime Minister, war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court, continues to claim that apartheid Israel is a safe haven for Christians. Well, Palestinian Christian theologian, the Reverend Dr. Munzir Ishaq, the pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Hope in Ramallah, Palestine, and the director of the Bethlehem Institute for Peace and Justice, whom I've interviewed on this program before, responded to the claims by war criminal Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court, that apartheid Israel is a safe haven for Christians. He did so on January 24, 2026, in a segment from Christ at the Checkpoint podcast, with facts documented by Israeli institutions, heads of churches in Jerusalem, the Greek Patriarch of Jerusalem, Palestinian Christians living in occupied Palestine, and reports from polling institutions, and even going back to the first Nakba of 1948. He details Israeli attacks on Palestinian Christians in Palestine, including Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. In this podcast, the Reverend Dr. Munzir Ishaq also delivers a message to Christians around the world, and that is, talk to us, not about us. Let's listen in.
Dear friends, greetings, and wish you a blessed 2026. Welcome to a new episode of the Christ at the Checkpoint podcast, the first of our episodes in 2026. And we just hope and pray that 2026 will be a better year for all of us. The question I wish to address in this podcast is whether Israel is really the best place for Christians. You see, recently, Prime Minister, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claimed that in the Middle East, only, and I quote, one country protects the Christian community, enables it to grow, defends it, and makes sure that it thrives. And that country, according to Netanyahu, is Israel. There is no other, none, end quote. So let's actually take a listen to the whole quote.
So I want you to know that I spoke with President Trump yesterday. I said this publicly, too. I see the battle against us and the battle against our Judeo-Christian tradition basically being waged around the globe. And it's waged primarily by two forces, radical Shiite Islam and radical Sunni Islam. That means the axis that is led by Iran, much battered, admittedly, but still there, and the axis, the Sunni axis, led by the Muslim Brotherhood, which permeates everything. They go to Europe, they go to the United States, they go to Africa, Nigeria. And we are conscious of the fact that Christians are being persecuted across the Middle East, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Nigeria, in Turkey, and beyond. And we're also aware of the fact, as you are, that one country protects the Christian community, enables it to grow, defends it, and makes sure that it thrives. And that country is Israel. There is no other. None.
One country protects the Christian community. Actually, I think further he went on and said that he wants to create a global front to protect Christians around the world. Netanyahu wants to do that. So how do I respond, and how do we respond? And I would like to do so not emotionally, not ideologically, but factually. Let's bring the receipts. Historically, let's talk about facts. And of course, I will speak as a Palestinian Christian who actually lives in this land and knows the reality firsthand. And I would like to begin by pointing to something very simple, that the irony here in what Netanyahu is claiming is so staggering. The irony is staggering. Why do I say that? Because literally as Netanyahu was saying these words, in the same time, the same period when Netanyahu is making these claims, Israeli institutions and the heads of churches in Jerusalem were saying the exact opposite. Exact opposite. So what do I mean? Let's begin by actually a slightly old report from last year by the Rosing Center, a Israeli, Jerusalem-based institution. The Rosing Center for Education and Dialogue is the name. It's actually one of the respected interfaith and research centers in Jerusalem. And by the way, by far not a left-leaning kind of institution. In 2024, they published their annual report on harassment and attacks against Christians in Jerusalem and Israel. And the Rosing Center's report on 2024 documents 111 cases and states clearly attacks against Christians, and states clearly that this phenomena is actually growing on attacks on Christians, and that there is a rise in incidents of harassments and violence against Christians in Jerusalem and in Israel. When we say 111 attacks, they include spitting on clergy, physical assaults, vandalism, defacing Christian property and symbols, harassment of worshippers, attacks on churches and monasteries. And actually, the report states that while the rise of harassment against Christians does not appear to be part of an official political agenda, that's what the report says, it nevertheless affirms that this troubling trend is, and I quote, unfolding in a climate marked by increasing state-backed nationalism and intolerance, which has become normalized by the state of Israel. Okay, this is the Rosing Center talking about a climate marked by increasing state-backed nationalism and intolerance, which has become normalized by the state of Israel. So this is not by the Palestinian Authority. This is happening inside Israel and Jerusalem, the areas that Israel occupies. And the report, by the way, does not address the issue of impunity enough. I think it's a failure by that report, but other reports do. So let's move to the next report, which, and this is the irony I stated, because this is really fresh. This is last month, a report by the Religious Freedom Data Center, an Israeli one. And they published data showing a sharp increase in attacks and harassment against Christians in 2025. So things did not get better in 2025. They got worse. And according to that center, from January to September 2025 alone, there were at least 144 documented incidents of harassment and violence against Christians in Israel and Jerusalem. So this is an increase. And it's the same attacks. Spitting on priests, nuns, monks, verbal abuse, vandalism, and harassments. The director actually made something very clear that these numbers are likely an undercount, Actually, the Rosing Center said the same thing, because many Christians do not bother reporting to the police anymore due to distrust, maybe fear, and the near certainty that nothing will happen. So this is impunity. The director of that center explained that attackers often act with a sense of total impunity, emboldened by political and social climate, and that very few cases ever lead to prosecution. So the question then is simple. How can anyone claim to be the protector of Christians while Israeli institutions themselves document a growing wave of attacks against Christians and a culture of impunity? See the irony here. And let's actually listen to the heads of churches in Jerusalem. Because in the same period that Netanyahu made these claims, the Greek Orthodox Patriarch of Jerusalem, Patriarch Theophilus III, said these words, that there is an existential threat to the Christian presence, an existential threat that is real and deepening. And he says, we continue to face violations and infringements of the rights of free access to the Holy Land. Actually, let's listen to his whole, to parts of his talk, which he gave this Christmas at the audience of the Jordanian king, actually.
The existential threat to the Christian presence is real and deepening, and we continue to face violations and infringements of the right of free access to the holy places. Christian Zionism, which is a misusing of the Christian Holy Scripture for political purposes. Christians in the Holy Land, radical groups at Al-Aqsa Mosque. We deny these violations. Any threat to Muslim holy places is and are watching with great concern the erosion of the historic status quo and the alarming infringements by a threat against our churches and Christian holy places.
So let's be clear. This is not a Palestinian politician. This is not an activist. This is the Greek Patriarch of Jerusalem. So again, I ask, if Israel is the best place for Christians in the Middle East, why are the heads of churches themselves speaking about existential threats? Wow. And in fact, the heads of churches as back as 2021 said something very interesting. In a joint statement, all the heads of churches said that these tactics of attacks against Christians are being used in a systematic attempt to drive the Christian community out of Jerusalem and other parts of the Holy Land. So we have the heads of churches talking about a systematic attempt. And they have similar statements, 2017 and 2020. So this is clearly systematic. And let me add something very important. Actually, just as I was about to begin recording this podcast, we received the news that Christian schools in Jerusalem, under the Israeli jurisdiction, are now on strike. Why? Because of a dispute with the Israeli authorities over permits for Palestinian Christian teachers, those who dwell in the West Bank and need a permit from the military to come from the West Bank to teach in Jerusalem. Now Israel is restricting or delaying or denying permits of Palestinian teachers who teach in schools, Christian schools in Jerusalem, teachers who have been in some cases serving these schools and communities for years. And as a result, the Christian schools in Jerusalem are no longer able to function normally. And so they issued a statement, actually. It's an official statement issued by the General Secretariat of Christian Educational Institutions in Jerusalem, the Christian schools. And the statement talks about how the schools are facing arbitrary and unjustified restrictions by Israel, and that dozens and dozens of teachers can no longer get permits, and that the new Israeli measures have already affected 171 teachers and staff. Wow. So schools are unable to guarantee the continuation of the academic year, and therefore they are forced to take protest measures and strikes. And these statements again say something even more important, that these measures do not serve Jerusalem as a city sacred to all, and that they only serve those who want to paralyze and undermine Christian education and presence in the city. So let us be very clear. Again, it is not under the Palestinian Authority. This is about Israel making Christian life in Jerusalem unworkable, even in education. And it's happening now, while Netanyahu is making these claims. And this is exactly, as I said, why the heads of churches, this is what they meant when they spoke about a systematic attempt to push Christians out. Of course, this goes beyond Jerusalem. And so let's talk about what's happening, for example, in the West Bank in Gaza. And I want to go to my hometown of Beit Sahur, where things are serious now because, and let's remember, Beit Sahur is probably the last Christian majority town in the Bethlehem area. And there is a threat of a new settlement on the land of Beit Sahur, which led the mayor of Beit Sahur to issue a strong warning about this new Israeli outpost that threatens the future of the town. Again, this is in December 2025, as Netanyahu was making these claims. Such a settlement means land confiscation. It means suffocation of the possibility of development of Beit Sahur, the fragmentation of the community, and of course, eventually the forced migration of people from Beit Sahur. This is a real threat to our community. When we saw forced migration, this is important. It's not as if people want to leave, but because life becomes impossible, especially if this West Bank, if this settlement in Beit Sahur is built. And of course, this is nothing new because most of the land of Bethlehem has been confiscated for several purposes, including building settlements and the land and the wall. There is an initiative in Bethlehem called the Balasan Initiative, and they have documented with clear maps and data what they'd call annexation by stealth. So the facts are clear that 85% of Bethlehem governorate is Area C, which means Palestinians cannot even build on these areas under full Israeli control. And as recently as 2025, there were two Israeli military orders that will effectively annex around 167,000 dunams, 167,000 dunams. As a result, the cumulative effect is that Bethlehem will be reduced to about 10% of its historic territory. Bethlehem, where the majority of Christians in the West Bank live. This is what Israel is doing to our land, all over the West Bank, but in Bethlehem, it's directly impacting the Christian presence. This is really strangulation. And this is pushing people outside. Is this new? Not at all. This is what Israel has been doing in the West Bank, pushing us out since the very beginning. It's systematic. And what happened in 1948, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, the Nakba, and when I use term like ethnic cleansing, it's well documented now that it was systematic, it was planned. Israeli historians themselves admit this. But when we talk about Palestinian Christians in particular, let's remember that when the Nakba happened, over 50,000 Palestinian Christians were displaced. A study documented around 30 Christian towns, communities that no longer exist. This is the essence of the Zionist colonialism. They displaced Palestinians and they replaced them with new people who came to our land, who literally took our homes. There are still homes that historically belonged to Palestinian Christians that are now inhabited by Israelis. Palestinian theologian and historian Mitri Rahib, in his seminal book, The Politics of Persecution, talked about that how 35% of all Christians in Palestine in the Nakba in 1948 lost their homes, land, work, and possessions. He said that Jerusalem lost 88% of its Christians, Haifa 52%, Jaffa 73%, Ramle 40%, and Lod 70%. And so the Christian share of the population dropped from 8% before the Nakba to 2.8% in just a few months. Without the Nakba, the currently 170 Christian Palestinians of historic Palestine would number nearly, according to Rahib, 600,000. 600,000. So Rahib actually writes in that book that the year of 1948 was a catastrophe for the Palestinian Christian community. They lost in numbers demographically. They lost a significant portion of their property, geography, and they lost the support of Western theologians. Palestinian Christians were not persecuted because of their faith, but they were disinherited physically and theologically for the simple reason that they were Palestinian Arabs. They were forced to make space for the European colonialism of Israeli state and Western theology. End quote. Again, this is what happened in 1948. And by the way, for years when Palestinians talked about these issues, we were discredited because Western Christians chose to believe our colonizers, those who occupied our land, and discredit our stories. But today, of course, all of this is well-known facts of history. And since then, like all Palestinians, Palestinian Christians have lived under military occupation, under checkpoints, settlements, the apartheid wall, daily humiliation. And as I said, even we were not allowed to speak to Western Christians about this. There are several studies about life under occupation for Palestinian Christians and even for those citizens of Israel. One I recommend is the Kairos Palestine and Bedil joint report. I can post a link to that report, which documents with data and facts a continuous system of displacement, land confiscation, denial of return, residency revocation, fragmentation of communities, and forced migration, not as isolated policies, but as a coherent regime designed to make Palestinian life, including that of Palestinian Christians, unsustainable. And of course, we all know what's happening in Gaza, where Palestinian Christians are victims of a genocide alongside their Muslim neighbors. In this war, churches were attacked, families have been killed, entire families. And the ancient Christian community there, sadly, tragically, is on the brink of extinction. We all know about the attack on the church of St. Porphyrios at the beginning of the war, which is actually one of the oldest churches in the world, which has been bombed. And let's be clear, when it comes to attacking churches in this war, this was not a mistake. Let's be clear. Why do we say this? Because it did not happen as if once. It did not happen twice. In fact, during the war, two Christian women were shot by Israeli snipers inside the church compound in front of the church door. Israel has the GPS coordinates. They know exactly what they were doing. Gaza, as I said, has one of the oldest Christian communities on earth. And now we fear that it is being erased. So much for protecting Christian presence. And again, in places like Taiban, going back to the West Bank, now we're beginning to feel that Christians are being targeted. This is, Taiba is the last old Christian town in the West Bank. It's a small village and has been the target of several settlers' attacks in the last few months, where cars, homes have been burned, vandalized, oil of trees. And this happened again and again, despite international campaigns by the Christian community there. So again, this is not like something that happened once and was not repeated. So again, we ask, this is the best country for Christians, really? Let's go back to Jerusalem, because I think that's where the heart of the issues are, where there is a clear assault on our freedom of worship as Palestinian Christians indigenous of this land. Because for the first time in history, Jerusalem is cut from the rest of the Palestinian towns. In particular, now Jerusalem and Bethlehem are separated. This has never happened before. And the indigenous people of Bethlehem are not able to go to pray in Jerusalem, needing a permit by the military. Again, this is when we inside don't know whether to laugh or get angry when someone like Mike Huckabee said, there is no occupation, it's all Judea and Samaria, there is no occupation. Well, if there is no occupation, why do I need a permit from the Israeli military to get from Jerusalem to Bethlehem? And who knows if I'll get this permit or if the people will get it. And in fact, even inside Jerusalem, sometimes the people of the old city of Jerusalem, the Christian community, are not able to go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre itself. This happens during the Holy Saturday, Saturday of Light, Sept and Nur. Many times there are attacks on the Christians who are trying to go pray. Israel limits the access to that church, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, decides how many people can go pray there, and they limit the number under the pretext of security. I mean, the church knows how many people can fit in that church. The church can absorb, I think, close to 10,000 people. Israel limits the number sometimes to 1,500, sometimes to 2,000. But to think that, you know, for us, not only us in the West Bank, how we feel when we see pilgrims going freely from Bethlehem to Jerusalem, how the people of Jerusalem themselves feel when people from outside, the pilgrims, come into the church while the indigenous people are not able to. Just think of that for a moment, how painful it is for us. And I say Jerusalem is at the heart of the issue, because Jerusalem, with its symbolism, with its historical significance, its religious significance, is now being reshaped. And this is a serious matter for us as Christians. Through laws, through planning, through archaeology, through demographic engineering, it's no longer a shared city. They wanted a city of one identity, one narrative, one people, Israeli Jewish. And I believe this is why Christian feasts are attacked year after year, especially the Holy Saturday, as I said. And this is, I think, behind the taxation issue, where Israel now wants to tax churches for the first time since the days of the Ottomans. I mean, even the Ottomans, when they occupied our land, decided that churches are tax exempt. Why? Because they serve the community. And now Israel wants to tax churches hundreds of millions of shekels, because they want to do it retroactive from 1967. One church leader commented on this, the attempts to tax churches. The only way to pay what Israel is claiming that the churches owe it is if we sell the Church of the Holy Sepulchre itself. This could literally put an end to the Christian presence in Jerusalem. What's happening in Jerusalem is very, very serious. And maybe just one final comment about this. Because if Israel is truly genuine, if Netanyahu is genuinely concerned about Christians in the Middle East and he wants to protect us and so on, I have a very simple solution that will all of a sudden solve the issue of the small number of Christians in Palestine. Give us the right of return. That's it. Allow the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian Christians around the world who are denied the right sometimes even to visit their land, their homes. Give us the right to return to our land from our homes from which we were expelled in 1948 and 1967. So you cannot really claim to protect Christians while preventing indigenous Christian people from returning to their country. So let's be real here. Now, in one, I think it was in the Christmas greeting, Netanyahu mentioned an incident that happened in the West Bank, in the city of Jenin, under the control of the Palestinian Authority. Of course, Israel occupies everything militarily, but Jenin is under the Palestinian Authority. What actually happened is that a few individuals in the night burned the Christmas tree in the city of Jenin, where there are a few hundreds of Christians who still live there. So what happened when the Christmas tree was burned? There was, of course, a lot of condemnation by the Palestinian community to this. The Palestinian Authority moved swiftly, and the perpetrators were immediately identified, arrested by the Palestinian Authority. A new tree was erected, actually, and Muslim and Christian leaders stood together when that happened, when they erected the Christian, the new tree. It was a big celebration. My good friend Jack Sarah of the Bethlehem Bible College, the president, wrote these words. about what happened in the aftermath of burning of the Christmas tree. He said when the incident occurred, the perpetrator was immediately identified, arrested, and imprisoned by the Palestinian Authority. A new Christmas tree was erected, as he said. The celebration, Reverend Jack says, continued in the presence of Christian clergy, Muslim religious leaders, civic officials, and representatives of the Palestinian Authority. Rather than exposing religious intolerance, the incident demonstrated accountability, communal solidarity, and deeply rooted Muslim-Christian coexistence, end quote. And compare this with the impunity we mentioned about the hundreds of attacks against Christians in Jerusalem and the Israeli areas versus this one incident and how the community responded. See, when settlers attack Taiba, for example, or in Jerusalem, they spit at priests. There is almost never accountability. There is almost never punishment. And there is almost always impunity. Now, a question that is often raised these days is the question of Christians leaving Palestine, immigration. It's a big wound. We are leaving one family at a time. Why is this happening? And I think all of this is important, because remember what Netanyahu was claiming. The Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research, very trusted and respected polling institution in Palestine and the region, actually, conducted recently a survey that was funded by the Philos Project. The Philos Project is, interestingly, a Christian Zionist organization. Philos wanted to conduct the survey to prove what they've been promoting falsely, that Palestinian Christians are leaving because Muslims are pushing them out. But the results of the survey actually destroyed that narrative that they wanted it to. The report actually, and you can look at it up with details, but in the results, it says that the overwhelming majority of Palestinian Christians indicate that they face no irritation or harassment from their Muslim neighbors or at schools and workplaces. Interesting. The report found that the main reasons people consider leaving is economic strangulation, occupation measures, checkpoints, settler attacks, land confiscation. Not about Muslim attacks, it's about the occupation. And if you follow what Israel has been doing over the years, they have been misusing the statistics about the decline of Christians in Bethlehem since the Palestinian Authority took over in the 90s, falsely claiming that Muslims or the PA are pushing Christians out. Whereas we've been saying for years, Christians are leaving because of the occupation. And this study and many others prove the opposite. And I actually know from friends who knew people inside the Philos Project, which funded this study, that those who funded it were very uncomfortable with the results, tried to alter or change or reconsider publishing because it contradicted their own political narrative. So we really need to ask, why does Netanyahu say these things? Why does he claim these things? Now, this is not a new tactic. It's important. Because for decades, the Zionist discourse has tried to reframe a colonial and apartheid reality into a religious conflict. That's why Netanyahu often speaks of the Judeo-Christian values versus Islam, Arabs and Muslims. They present Israel as a protector of Christianity. Actually, sometimes they would say they are fighting on behalf of American Christians against radical Islam. This is political manipulation. It's meant to hide settler colonial reality and dangerously turn the conflict into Christians versus Muslims or Jews versus Muslims and silence the indigenous Palestinian Christians because our mere existence poses threat to this false dichotomy, this false narrative. And there is also something important here. Netanyahu is saying these things because he knows that he has the ears of many Western Christians, especially in the United States, who will believe these lies. To me, this is a tragedy, a real tragedy, that many Christians are willing to listen to a war criminal accused of genocide more than they listen to Palestinian Christian leaders. That's the reality. Many Christians really believe a war criminal like Netanyahu more than they believe even Palestinian Christian leaders. So I would say, I'm not saying or responding because I'm only a Palestinian. I'm bringing facts. I'm bringing facts. And as Palestinian Christians, we reject to be used in such a way by Netanyahu for colonial purposes when we are the victims ourselves of those colonial policies and acts on the ground. Now we as an indigenous community are being erased. And let me be very, very clear. We as Palestinian Christians surely do not want a criminal who committed genocide to defend us. We're not asking for that. And if really there is a genuine concern to protect us, let's end occupation, let's end apartheid, let's hold war criminals accountable. And to the Christians around the world, I must say, talk to us, not about us. We're more than willing and capable on speaking on our own behalf. We don't want people to speak on our own behalf. We can speak for ourselves. So I hope that the next time you talk about Christians and the Holy Land, Palestinian Christians, why we're leaving all of these, that you listen actually to the leaders of the church, rather than to the false claims of Netanyahu.
What you just heard was a segment from Christ at the Checkpoint podcast, where Palestinian Christian theologian, the Reverend Dr. Munzir Ishaq, the pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Hope in Ramallah, Palestine, and the director of Bethlehem Institute for Peace and Justice, whom I've interviewed on this program before, respond to the claims by war criminal Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court, that apartheid Israel is a safe haven for Christians. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.